Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. During the mid-1980s, a brutal killing spree began in Los Angeles as several women were murdered, having been sexually assaulted and shot in the chest with the same 25 caliber gun. The man responsible was Lonnie David Franklin Jr. However, his identity wouldn't be revealed for more than 20 years, by which time he had become one of America's most prolific serial killers. At the time, Los Angeles was a city struggling under the weight of racial inequalities and a crack epidemic that was sweeping through its most deprived areas. The victims were black women, and often addicts and sex workers. Many in the communities of South Central felt that these factors all caused a lack of interest on the part of LAPD in investigating the murders, allowing Franklin to carry on his killing spree undetected. The book that we're featuring this evening is The Grim Sleeper, talking with America's most notorious serial killer, Lonnie Franklin Jr., with my special guest journalist and author and filmmaker, Victoria Redstall. Welcome back to the program, and thank you very much for agreeing to this interview, Victoria Redstall.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to the program. Congratulations on The Grim Sleeper and this exclusive interviews with Lonnie Franklin Jr., which you come up with this end product, The Grim Sleeper, talking with America's most notorious serial killer. As you do write in the book, tell us, you mention a couple people that you thank right off immediately for access to information and all the help in putting this incredible book together. So as you do, tell us, just without much introduction, who these people are that you thank for this book.
I believe one of them is my father. I believe another group is a whole bunch of Los Angeles County sheriffs, a number of them, and also Cliff Shepard, one of the main homicide detectives that was involved right from the very beginning, before the Grim Sleeper was even caught.
Right. Let's talk about the relationship you do have with Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department and how you first got access to Lonnie Franklin Jr. First off, tell us why you were interested in this case, but tell us about the relationship that you have with some of this, the police department, and which is very helpful in you being able to have the access that you did to be able to write this book.
Well, my involvement with Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department molded me to be the person I am today. I started it when I came to America at 19, and for various reasons, because I had a number of stalkers, wanted to get to know a cop. That cop turned into 2 to 5 to 10 to the entire West Hollywood Sheriff's Station. I was then a civilian volunteer because I wasn't a citizen of the country. So I was allowed to be a civilian volunteer, but I wasn't allowed to train to be an actual Los Angeles County Sheriff. That came many, many, many years later when I trained to be a sheriff. That's my involvement there. So I've worked with them. I've ridden along, obviously, on the ground thousands of times and in the air, in the helicopter as well. And, of course, been very hands-on with them because of being a civilian volunteer. You learn so much by being around them every day. So that's what I did from the age of 19, 20, 21 when I first came to America. Now, decades later, I've always had that involvement. And because of family friends that were murdered by a mass murderer when I was 11 years old, I've also always been very interested in the mind of these heinous murderers, serial killers and mass murderers, because of what happened to me when I was 11. So when I was offered to do a documentary back many years ago, I think it was 2007, I jumped at that opportunity. And since then, I've been able to get in the mind of various different serial killers and also help with different homicide detectives, not just sheriffs, but LAPD. Also, in Canada, where you are, in Canada, there was somebody in Winnipeg. They were working with me, getting in the mind of a serial killer called Sean Cameron Lamb. So there's many different avenues I've worked with law enforcement. That's just more of a recent one in the last 11 years has been with homicide detectives, helping them close cases. So I was commissioned for my first book, and it snowballed from there. And my most recent book, On the Grim Sleeper, came out a couple of months ago in June.
Now, you have to contact serial killers, and you have a knack for being able to get the information that no one else has. And as I mentioned just earlier, that this was an exclusive agreement that you were able to negotiate with Lonnie Franklin Jr. so that he wouldn't speak to anyone else and speak to you exclusively. Tell us.
Absolutely.
It's July 7th, 2010, when you find out when finally this person that's been terrorizing Los Angeles, Lonnie David Franklin Jr., is arrested. Now, from that point, how do you contact Lonnie Franklin Jr.? How do you approach him to ensure, as you have done before, that you've been able to do this? How do you ensure this time that he will respond? And tell us a little bit, give our audience a little bit on how you negotiate this with this person.
Well, what happened was I had to wait for him to be classified. Classified means when an inmate is allowed to have a visitor for the first time. That can be a process of a week or so or a couple of months. Because he was charged with being this serial killer known as the Grim Sleeper, therefore it took months for him to be classified since his arrest on July 7th, 2010. So it was actually the end of September, I believe, beginning of October, when he got classified. And that's when I called up the jail, because I kept calling every month. I was calling to see when he was classified. So it was very early on, when he was classified, that I went to the jail. I showed up in the high-powered lane, the line, where you stand for about 45 minutes waiting in the cold or in the heat to get in to see your inmate. Usually it's a family member. So that's how it happened. In October 2010, I stood in that line and I waited to go in. Now, what I had thought was he would have received the letter that I had sent a week before. So I thought, okay, he's going to receive my letter. He knows what I look like because I always send a headshot. He knows what I look like and he knows I'm English. And I told him about myself and I told him that I'm going to visit him. However, because of the high profile that he is in an ADSEG unit, which is administrative segregated from all the other inmates, so he's high power.
Right.
I didn't get to him. It takes about 8 weeks, sometimes 2 or 3 months, to get to one of these types of inmates. So actually, he didn't have a clue who I was. So when I went in to the area, there was about eight visiting areas where you can sit, and they're behind glass. I was looking at each of the inmates. One was a white guy, one was Hispanic, another one was Hispanic, one was a little frail black guy, another one was Hispanic, and then there was a white guy. Well, there was only one black guy out of all the people there. I mean, I'm thinking,
right. This
guy looks quite large on the screen and in the papers. So I didn't think it was him, and I looked back at him, and he was just shaking his head, you know, because he'd never seen me, didn't even know who I was, because he didn't get that letter. He just was expecting his wife to visit him. I don't believe he thought anyone but his wife would visit him. And I sat there, and I saw his hand, and his hand said, Lonnie David Franklin Jr. And then I realized that was him. It looks totally different, but it was him. So I sat with him, and he looked like he'd seen a ghost. He leapt back in his chair and shook his head. I said, no, it's okay. I'm for you. And he goes, no, because we couldn't. The phone lines went up. So then I said, no, trust me, I am. So it was a little awkward for the first 2 minutes, but then when the phone lines got up, when they started to work, I said, hey, you know, Lonnie, I'm Victoria, the one who wrote you the letter. He said, what letter? I said, well, you know, it used to be my mechanic. And, of course, I was winking at the time through the screen because everything's recorded.
Right.
So I said, you know, remember my car always had a problem? See, I knew he was a mechanic. That's all I knew. I said, oh, yeah. He said, yeah, man. Oh, yeah, I remember. Yes, I said, and you used to always fix it for free, didn't you? Yeah. How's your car doing? I said, oh, it's sold now. And we started talking that way. And then I said, oh, by the way, on a side note, you know what I'm doing now? I'm writing books on two different kinds of people. People who are locked up wrongly and charged with a crime they didn't commit. Or I'm writing books also on serial killers. So you, I'm sure, Lonnie, you're going to fit into one area, right? And so he's either innocent or he's going to be convicted when we get to trial.
Yeah.
Almost 5 years later. And I said, but listen, how about I write a book on you? And he goes, oh, okay. I said, this is what I want from you. 100% exclusivity, 100%. Now, I'll come here every Thursday. I'll make your day. I'm fun as hell, high energy. I'm definitely going to make you laugh. And I want to have your word, and I want you to sign it. So he sent me a letter signing something to give me his exclusive life story. And because he wasn't convicted yet, he wasn't going to talk about the crimes. He talked about everything except the actual crimes. And that's why my book focused more on his life growing up than the actual crimes themselves.
Right.
And that's how it happened.
That's very interesting. You talk about, too, that this correspondence included telephone calls, interviews, like you say, between plexiglass, but face-to-face, and also letters. And you say that your father even joined you for a number of these interviews. Tell us, what was the purpose and how did your father find these? How did he find these interviews for him personally?
Well, my father found them a lot of fun because, again, because you're not talking about the crimes, what I've always done is compartmentalize. So my father was getting to know him on a different level, you know, what he likes to cook, what sports team he likes, what was it like growing up in Los Angeles, because, of course, we all grew up in England. So little things like that was where they had a great banter, and I remember they slapped the screen, the plexiglass, when we said goodbye, giving a high five to each other. So I remember that very well. So, yes, I took my father down. I've taken my parents to death row a couple of times. So it's not like I don't include my parents in my life. I have an exciting life. Why not share it? So yes, I have. I've done that for the experience and for the fact that my father was instrumental in the one who said, why don't you write to that guy, the Grim Sleeper? Because before he got caught, my very first serial killer interview was with a man called Wayne Adam Ford. And I always said that I would stay in touch with him, and I do. He calls once a month from death row. But before then, I would visit him maybe once a year just to kind of keep in with him and also work with him on pilots and TV shows and shows for A&E and Investigation Discovery. Well, one of the times, this is long before 2010, it must have been 2007 or 8, when he was on death row, he said to me, why don't you go out and try to find the Grim Sleeper? Now, I didn't know who that was. This is long before the arrest. And he said, listen, I'll give you the demographics. I'll give you the profile of what I believe he is. And it was Wayne Ford that told me he's going to be a black guy. He's going to be African-American. He's probably a family man. He's probably married. I wouldn't be surprised if he'd been married many years. And he's probably one of those guys that people like in the neighborhood. Now, I'm telling you, that serial killer, Wayne Adam Ford, hit the nail on the head dead on.
Yeah.
Because that's exactly who Lonnie Franklin is. He's been married almost 40 years to Sylvia. He is a family man to an extent. And he was very much liked by the neighbors, and he was a fun-loving guy. Now, the African-American part, I asked Wayne, why do you think he's going to be African-American? He says, because we serial killers, we usually stick with our own race when killing. And I didn't know that at the time. So actually, you do learn from serial, you learn from your subject. So yes, I didn't necessarily go to school to learn about serial killers. I got it from the horse's mouth. And that's what he said. He said that they stick to their own race. And if you look at the innocent victims that Lonnie Franklin killed, every one of them was African-American.
We have covered this case before with Christine Pelisic. And so, but your take on this is much different. Like you say, you focus on, from his own perspective, his own words, he has the opportunity to tell you exactly what happened in his life, and then you speak to everybody surrounding him that will possibly speak to you, which is numerous. You have that ability. Right from the very beginning, you say you're gonna have a fun time with me. He is awaiting trial, so he couldn't confess anything to you, even if he really wanted to, and the trial would be completely different. And so you talk about this taking 5.5 years. So right in 2010, October, you start. tell us, like a typical visit, say without your father, tell us what that's like. What's his demeanor like? What's his intellect like, actually? Always these serial killers are depicted as almost morons later at a sentencing phase in their trial. But tell us what he was really like at that visit in his correspondence. What's the tone? What are you guys talking about? What's he sharing with you and how?
Well, he was a very, very talkative guy. And that doesn't help because I'm also talkative. So I very rarely got a word in. But he would be bouncing up and down. He was excited. He would sit there. He was always looking at people going around behind me. And I used to say, hello, you know, like Judge Judy, eyes. I put my, you know, two fingers to my eyes.
Yeah.
Look at me. Hello. I'm here with you. Do you mind? And, of course, the sheriff's department very kindly gave me three times extra time because you only get 20 minutes mm-hmm. with a high-powered inmate. But they knew me but since I was a kid, since I was 19. So they gave me three times that. So I would have an hour, a full hour with him, which was very lucky. So anyway, yes, he would be full of energy telling me stories about the other inmates because he used to be driven nuts by a guy called Alex Da Silva, who was in for rape. In my opinion, he did not do it at all. He's as innocent as the day is long. And he knows that, and I think now he's out of prison. But point being is he just hated this guy, Alex Da Silva. And he said Alex made up so much noise and he wants to watch movies and I can't get any sleep at night. And then there was one of the rappers that was in with him and another star from DeBarge. There's quite a few well-known people. Ryan O'Neill's son was in as well. So there's a lot of people that he would talk about. And then some that he would also talk about that they didn't know his name. And so many different things, thinking that they were a cop that went bad or that they were working with the FBI, which actually turned out to be completely true. Because years later, when the sheriff's department, all of them went to prison, that guy, Anthony Brown, actually was in that ADSEG unit. So it's the plot kind of thickens there and goes off in different directions. But bringing it back to your question, it was just, he was very fun and he wanted to talk a lot about that. I had to try and reel him in. I said, listen, Lonnie, I can't hear about all the gossip on your row. You know, his cell is on a row. I don't need to hear that. But if you could just let me know when you grew up and your brother came from Texas to your half-brother and how much you loved him, tell me about those times. And then when I reeled him back in, he would then let loose and tell me all about his brother or his sister or his kids, the illegitimate kids that he'd had that his wife doesn't know about. So he would tell me, don't put that in the book. Oh, but you can put that in the book. And then it got so late that I don't know what I put in the book that he didn't want me to, because he was so fast with his speech and so all over the place that I hope that I didn't put anything in that he didn't want me to.
You talk about his early life and somewhat normal upbringing, but tell us about what he had said about his life and any events that he tried to, I guess, attribute to him going bad at some point. Tell us about his early life.
His early life, I believe, from what he tells me, was that he had a very good childhood with the home life, with his parents, with his grandparents, with his siblings, his sister. It was good. There weren't fights. Nobody was crazy. Everything was normal, unlike a typical serial killer. However,
sure,
at school, he was bullied relentlessly. Now, in my opinion, that's what molded him. That's what molded him. So, yes, he was bullied relentlessly because of his size. Not just the fact he's very short, which he is. I believe he's 5'6", 5'6", 5'7", maybe. But he was very fat as a kid. And the bullying didn't stop. It was everywhere. Any school he was in, any class he was in, he was made to look like a joke. I believe that this is what affected him, because usually serial killers, they are formed. You know, they are not necessarily born a serial killer. They are formed with a lethal cocktail. And usually it's abuse of the parents or siblings, abuse, whether it be sexual or physical, abandonment, all of those issues. That's what he didn't have. But he had such abuse from his schoolmates, his peers. That's what I think molded his life. And being short and being fat, I believe he wanted to have power over people, as serial killers do. They want that sense of ultimate power, and that's at the hands of them to kill someone and see the life being robbed from them. So that made him feel powerful, killing these innocent victims.
You talk about his stint in the army. Tell us about that stint.
Oh, gosh, the stint in the army. He liked the army a lot. I mean, that's what he wanted to do, and took that bus and ended up in the army. He liked Germany, but he's always liked black females. He's not attracted to white females. He tried that once in Germany, and it wasn't for him. But later I find out that it was the woman he had sex with that he said was a whore because she was loose. The woman that she had sex with, apparently this was a gang rape. It came out in trial. She actually was flown over from Germany. So he would twist the story, making it look like he'd had sex with this German girl, when really he raped her with two other men, and ended up in, I believe, in some kind of prison or short time in jail, but was thrown out of the army because of that ordeal. But so yes, he would take drugs from one area to another area of Germany when he was stationed out in Germany. He never took drugs himself, according to him, and I kind of believe him, because his way of getting women, and later in life proved that with the women that he did kill, was to actually get the drugs for them, and that was another way of getting them in his grasp, whether to have sex with them, whether to have sex with them and kill them, or whatever he was trying to do. So yes, he had a good time in Germany, and one experience with that white female, and the rest were with black females.
You talk about, too, that he started his criminal career as a thief of stolen vehicles and other possession of stolen property, but oddly, there is no talk of violence among friends, family, girlfriends, and employees, anything like that. There really isn't any talk of that, is there?
No, there's not. There was one incident. There was two incidents. He was not a violent man, but there were two incidences with two different kinds of women. And one, I believe, was in self-defense, because he had a woman for a very, very short time. She was, again, very loose, as he explained to me. He got into bed very quickly, and obviously had no respect for her because of that. But this is going back decades and decades. And then what happened was she was in a fight with him and started to hit him. Well, he didn't like that, and then he hit her across the face in defense of himself. That caused her to have severe bruising on the face. So he pretended to stay with her for a few days longer till the bruising went down, because he didn't want her to leave the house, or I don't know whose house, I think it was her house. He didn't want her to go out looking like that and him getting into trouble. That was one incident where he was violent. There was a second incident when he was a kid. There was a fight that he had to break up. And that was, I think, between two girls. He got in and ended up protecting one girl against the other. I believe I wrote that in my book. It's been such a long, intense case that some of the facts that I have written that are facts or were told to me back then as facts have slipped my mind. But I believe there's only been two incidences. I asked him, I said, have you ever hit Sylvia? Sylvia is his wife. And He said, oh, no, never in a million years. He said, she would throw knives at me. She would throw knives at me if I ever tried to lay a hand on her. So he led me to believe, according to him, that his wife was the one who maybe had a little tendency to go towards violence and not him. I don't believe he was violent to women or to men. I don't think that's in him. But I do believe that he had, a lot of serial killers aren't violent. That's what's such a dichotomy of what I'm saying here. They may not be violent with anyone. Look at the Green River Killer, Gary Ridgway. He was married for 18, 19 years to Judith Ridgway, and he killed 72 prostitutes. I mean, the mind boggles, and he strangled them. He never laid a hand on Judith, because Judith told me, and he never raised his voice to her, and they bred puppies. So actually, a lot of serial killers, and I would say the majority of the ones I've met, have never been violent, but yet they will be violent for those types of females, usually, that are of a certain type of female. They're the ones that they want to kill. They will be as violent and as horrific to them that you can imagine.
Mm-hmm. You talk about Lonnie leaving the army in 1975. He was, like you say, kicked out of the army basically for that gang rape that he was did less than a year in prison for. After 5 years in the army, he was 24 years old, and he returned to California September 76. And that's talk about he fell in love with Sylvia, his later wife. You talk about they were married in 77. They were married for 39 years, and they had a daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But he continued it after he met her. She tolerated his antics, his affairs, and his criminality during that time, during that relationship. And there was a garage that Lonnie had. He told her to stay out of that garage, didn't he?
Yeah, I think there were three garages. Yes, there were. And he told her to stay out. I mean, she did as she was told. And plus, I don't think anyone would want to go in. It was like a pack rat. There was hardly any space to move in those garages. That's where he kept everything. I think he kept the porn videos. He kept videos of himself with these prostitutes. He kept the photographs that he took, the Polaroids of women that are assumed to be dead at his hands, but some of them were never found and some were found. And of course, Anitra Washington, thank God she lived to tell the tale. And it was her Polaroid picture in the garage as well. So there was a lot in that garage that she wasn't allowed to go in. But I don't know that she knew about the affairs.
Right. Getting back to your correspondence, he has been arrested. Then we will talk about Henrietta and being the star witness and being a survivor and everything surrounding that. But let's talk more about how long this trial was delayed for. We mentioned it and why. And in that ensuing time, you say you regularly visited him, had phone calls, and had correspondence. If you're not going to talk about the upcoming trial and his guilt or innocence, then, and he's talking about his family, what was that like? Again, you talk about him being distracted and going off on tangents, but that's a long time to be corresponding with someone. Tell us about that long, detailed correspondence and what was it characterized by?
Oh, I didn't. Once I had done the book, I had no reason to go back to the jail. And I believe his defense asked me not to go back or told me I couldn't go back to the jail, which is what left so many unanswered questions in my book. So there was a lady that she was like disbarred for a while, but she was the original defense attorney for Lonnie Franklin. I think her name was, what was it, Christine? She was out of Sherman Oaks. Anyway, it doesn't matter, but whoever took over from her was a raving lunatic, and that is why the trial was delayed so long, and I'll tell you all about that guy in a moment. But the trial, I actually visited him from the October 2010, probably for just a year, just over a year. And then it was a perfect timing because when I got banned, I didn't really need any more solid information from Lonnie Franklin. But and it wasn't come from the sheriff's department because they wouldn't have banned me. It was the defense lawyers that asked the sheriff's department to not let me in to see him. So what happened was I had just the end of the book were the questions that I had from the beginning, and those weren't answered, and that's the problem. So I didn't have more than a year, year and a half of visits with him and phone calls. And a lot of it, nearing the trial, we talked about it because he was still in the papers years before he came to trial. And he was in the paper,
right.
He was accused of possibly killing 180 females. Because when they did a search warrant, the LAPD did the search warrant in his home, they took out all the photographs, not just the ones from the garage, which were the ones from the possible victims, but the ones from the photo albums where he actually himself was in the picture, but apparently LAPD tore him out and put the pictures up. And I understand LAPD's point. They are doing it to see, did he kill people he knew? Did he kill family members? Their hands were, I hate to say tied, but they didn't know what they were looking for. LAPD did a fabulous job of finding him and looking for him. And they had a task force as well with a huge amount of officers on board. But I believe they just took every female picture in his home when I don't believe it was 180, but who knew back then when they arrested him in 2010? When he's been killing for 3 decades, you know, the number is just probably astronomical. And I believe that I think he was convicted of 10 or 11, but I know for a fact it's way more than that because some of these souls were never found.
Right. You also talk about the Los Angeles and surrounding areas, and also the definition, if people don't know, what a strawberry is, as opposed to a regular, I guess, you know, regular victim. So tell us a little bit about what the state was at that time that contributed to these people being in this ultra vulnerable position for Lonnie.
Yeah, Payton. That's what's so sad. These women didn't choose a life to go into the sex working business. However, I believe that by being addicted to drugs, which any of us could be addicted to a drug, and it just takes hold of you, I believe that with the addiction came the desperate need for money. and the desperate need for money, how do you do that quickly? I would assume that's what happened, because every one of these victims had drugs in their system. So that leads you to believe that they were on drugs at the time and probably had an addiction problem. So a strawberry, from what I believe, is a female that doesn't take money for sex. They take drugs for sex. And that's what a strawberry is. And that was a name made up in South Central LA in the 80s because of the crack epidemic. And that's what Lonnie Franklin did. He'd actually get the drugs for these women. So it wasn't necessarily money was exchanged. It was more so drugs were exchanged.
Later on in the book, you talk about a detective challenging him and saying, listen, this is the evidence we have against you. We have the DNA evidence. And you go cruise this avenue here, and you're trying to pick up women every night. What was the demeanor on the strip with him? We see lots of people that are good with their families, but what was Lonnie's reputation among the women and the people out on the streets at that time? Did he fool them? Were they aware of his propensity for violence, or how did they view him?
They did not feel that he was a violent man, and he fooled everybody. Everybody, neighbors, family members, the women on the street, everybody he fooled. There were prostitutes that he knew as friends that he never killed. I mean, he just had them as friends. I don't know what it was where he would pick some women over others. Don't quite know. But he had friends who were females. So those females would vouch for him. It was a shock to a lot of those females on the street. And he'd have them over at his home. And then I think he let some of them go. I don't know what the reason was, but some of them, he never was violent with them. He either, if he was violent with a woman, he killed them.
One thing, and I think we're just jumping a little bit ahead, but I want to mention this at this point, because I think this is a very important point a little bit later on when somebody tries to ask the question, why? Why did someone like this turn into this kind of person, and why did he let so many women go and just some he had to kill, he felt the need to kill. What was it? When we go back to When we go back to Germany, you mention in the book, you talk about in the book that the woman that was gang raped, to show his mentality at that time, a young man in Germany, she lured him back after that gang rape the next day on some premise of a date.
Mm-hmm.
And that facilitated the police being able to make the arrest and then convict the other two members of this little gang rape here. But it showed how naive he was, how cunning she was, and determined she was. But, again, I thought we'd mention that because if we explain a little bit later what you find out and what people conclude is that we come back to that very important event that he did barely even a year. And it seems like no one knew till much, much later in time. Let's use this as an opportunity, Victoria, just to stop for a second to speak about our sponsor, Blue Apron. Blue Apron delivers farm-fresh ingredients and step-by-step recipes to your door. Blue Apron's mission is to make incredible home cooking accessible to everyone. Blue Apron achieves this by supporting a more sustainable food system, setting the highest standards for ingredients, and building a community of home chefs. You choose self-designed, chef-designed recipes. Cook incredible meals in as little as 20 minutes. Let Blue Apron do the meal prep for you. Every week, at least 3 recipes built with your busy schedule in mind, where Blue Apron has done the meal prep for you, prepared sauces, spices, and ingredients. I cooked this week the stir-fried chili chicken with broccoli and rice. It was delicious. But I cooked the cod and coconut curry bowl. It was fantastic. This took 40 minutes. It had a Vanduvian curry powder as one of the ingredients. It had garlic and mustard seeds. It had brown rice and coconut milk, which just seemed to offset the hot spice. It was delicious. It was gourmet. It was easy, quick, and I made it myself. So check out this week's menu and get your first 3 meals free at blueapron.com/murder. That's blueapron.com/murder to get your first three meals free. Blue Apron, a better way to cook. Now, Victoria, we were talking about Lonnie Franklin Jr., and we were mentioning his life, how he had fooled everyone. And we were talking about this very, very important person in this entire story, this Anitra Washington. And this is November 20th, 1988. Tell us what she recalls for the police. Tell us about her ordeal. What happens that day? How she comes to bump into Lonnie Franklin Jr., how he convinces her to come with him in the vehicle, and how it comes to be that he tries to kill her, and how does he do that?
Anitra Washington, she was so instrumental in the entire case and getting him convicted. She was amazing. I believe she was walking on the street to a party. I think she was going to a party in that area, and she saw an orange Pinto. And she loves cars. And she looked at the car, not him. And of course, I wasn't there so many decades ago, so I'm just relaying what I can remember from the trial and what she said to me personally, which was when I went there to, didn't quite interview her, but I did hear it speak to her. And she saw this Pinto, looking at it. He got out of the car and said, "You want a ride?" And she said, "No." And then he asked again, and she said, "No." She didn't want to get in the car. She just wanted to look at it. And I think the third time he asked if she wanted a ride, and he said to her, "Black women like you that have got an attitude." He implied that she had an attitude. And she didn't like that, and she wanted to prove to him that she's not that way. So she got in the car. What did she have to lose at that time? She thought she had nothing to lose. And she said that she'd go, "You can come to the party," something like that. So she told him the address of the party. And the only reason, according to Anitra, why she got in the car was to just prove him wrong, that black women don't have attitudes, or don't have attitudes not enough to get in the car. She just doesn't like short guys, and Lonnie Franklin is short, so why would she get in the car? It was a little bit vague, but point being is, on the third attempt, she got in the car and gave the address, and he stopped off at a house on the way. I personally believe it was his own house, because he'd forgotten the gun. So I think he went back to his own house to get the gun, and he got back in the car, and that's when she realized that she's driving nowhere near where the house was that she wanted to get to. And he kept driving on different streets. And at that moment, when she was challenging him, he pulled out the gun and shot her at point blank range with, I believe, the 22 caliber pistol, and hit her right in the chest. I mean, she was minutes from dying. She was then thrown right out of the car onto the street, onto the pavement. And she was just crawling, pulling herself along the parked cars along the side, just to get to her friend's house. Thank God her friend, I think it was one of her best friends, lived very close by. And the friend was out and didn't come home till, thank God, minutes later, to see her friend Anitra lying on her porch, pouring with blood, going in and out of consciousness. I mean, she thought she was going to die. And when going back to when she was in the car and she'd been shot and she was going in and out of consciousness, she remembers saying that, "I will haunt you. If I die, if you have killed me, I will haunt you for the rest of your life." So that was a plan if she was going to lose her life that day. And then she remembered and she recounted all of what was in his car. And I believe there was stuff for kids in the car. Well, of course, Christopher and Crystal were kids at the time. That's his son and daughter. So it would make sense. Everything fit, this Pinto and all about the car. And I mean, she was so profound in the way she came across, so strong and articulate. I believe she's, and Elle, of course, LAPD, they solved the whole thing. They got him convicted on ballistics, of course, DNA ballistics, and her testimony, eyewitness testimony, firsthand.
Before we got to that point, though, police got to that point, she gave a good description, and they felt it would be a good description of him and that vehicle. So that's what she gave to police. But police do not make an arrest as a result of that, do they? This continues.
No, they don't. Yeah.
Now, at some point...
I'm so sorry. There's a delay on the phone. I think that there was about a month or two that went by, and she said that he went by her home and said, "Do I know you?" Something about, "Do I know you?" I don't know how that happened, but she knows it was him that did that. And I think that she had said that that was because he wanted to make sure that she didn't remember who he was. But that stuck out in her mind. There wasn't enough to arrest him on, because I don't think they knew any, the cops didn't know anyone with a Pinto at the time. I don't know about that. You see, that's very vague to me. It was vague in the trial as well.
You talk about at the same time, amazingly and horrifyingly, that at the same time that the Grim Sleeper is operating in Los Angeles, in the same area, there's another serial killer called the South Side Slayer, Chester Turner. You talk a little bit about that, just in that for a while they didn't realize what they had in terms of serial killers, did they?
No, they didn't. I actually interviewed him countless times as well. Chester Turner was the South Side Slayer. He was killing the same types of people, women that worked on the streets, sex workers, people who were drug addicts. He would kill the exact same type, but in a totally different way. So it was plainly obvious to the law enforcement that they were looking for two different guys, one who killed with a small handgun, and the other one who killed with his bare hands. Now, Chester Turner is a 350-pound retired gang member. He calls himself an OG, an old gangster, and with a scar across his face, he could snap anybody's neck in a minute. But Lonnie Franklin is a very frail, 5'7" little guy. Hence, he used a gun, because I know he couldn't use his hands. I think he tried to strangle one of them once, and it didn't work, so he shot her. So that was his MO. That was the way he killed them. So the cops knew, just with the MO, that there were two different guys they were looking for.
You talk about, too, that along the way, the police are looking for good suspects, and at least what they thought was a good suspect, out came a Los Angeles County Sheriff Department Deputy Ricky Ross. Why was Ricky Ross initially a good suspect? Obviously, he wasn't the culprit, but why was he a good suspect?
Ricky Ross was a known, well, I hate to say, the bad apple, the one bad apple in the sheriff's department. He was known to frequent prostitution and prostitutes, and I think he was accused of and charged with taking drugs. So he fit the demographic of somebody who could possibly take a life of one of the prostitutes that he frequented. So, yes, they got the wrong guy. But he did try to sue the department, and I don't believe he won. I don't believe he won. But he was certainly a cop that went bad. But certainly not the killer.
Yeah, you say he was fired, but he sued for $400 million, but the case was settled out of court.
Yes.
At some point, you talk about, and we didn't mention a brother it's like a distant brother of Franklin, because he didn't grow up with him per se. That's Christopher Franklin. But the police are looking, and people will understand this from the East Area Rapist, Golden State Killer case, if they're familiar with this term, familial DNA analysis. So police start to look at that technique of DNA analysis and take a look if that would work in their search for the Grim Sleeper. So tell us how they do that. And of course, we know the result.
Yeah, it's a fantastic invention. I mean, this is a very new thing. Like, DNA was very new decades ago, but this was very, very new, and they experimented. I believe this was the first case, which was a hit. And because his son, Christopher Franklin, who is a convicted felon, he had many gun charges and drug charges on him. He was in the system. His DNA was in the system. So what happened in, I think, early 2000s, that was when his DNA was taken. But before Lonnie Franklin got arrested, so it must have been near to 2009, 2010, they found that the DNA that they had on all of these bodies, the same DNA, was not a direct match to that was what was in their system, but it was a familial match. The DNA was a familial match. And that's when they realized it has to be a family member of Christopher Franklin. And from what I believe they went and looked for the uncle first. That's Christopher Franklin's uncle, so Lonnie Franklin's brother.
Right.
He lived out in the Inland Empire, I believe Rancho Cucamonga, someone like that. And they were looking at him, but they realized that the crimes were in a 4-mile radius of South Central. Why would he come all the way each time out there? And then they realized, well, the brother, which is the actual father of Christopher Franklin, why do they look for him? Well, look at him. And they did. and they followed him. And it was in that fateful day in early July that they followed him to a pizza restaurant. And the cops were brilliant. I mean, they dressed up as busboys. They had a tray to collect everything that he would discard after he didn't eat it. And that was a piece of pizza with the cheese on it. And I believe that the DNA was taken from the cheese of the pizza crust that was left on the plate, along with a napkin and along with a glass of water. And all of that was put on a tray and taken as evidence. And, of course, the lunatic defense guy, the defense office attorney, was saying that it was illegally got hold of, which, I mean, everything fell through. I mean, it wasn't illegally got hold of. It, and that's what's one of his attempts to stall the case and make it, you know, have a hung jury or something like that. But it didn't. So that's what they did. They found it. And then they got the search warrant. I think it was July 7th. And they went in, and it took them 3 days to get all the evidence. They had a huge command post set up as well.
You talk about that they looked at this garage that was off limits to his wife, Sylvia, and in there were the things like, not only were there identification, some pieces of things belonging to the victims, but there was also people that they never did find. So there was further suspects as a result of what they found in that garage. Isn't that true?
You mean further suspects or further victims?
Well, you say the you talk about that there was some identification found from people that weren't directly linked at first, but then as a result of this were they were suspected victims because there was no bodies found.
I think so, yes. I thought you said suspects. No, victims. Yes, I believe there's a lot more victims. And in the 80s, he was a garbage collector. And he was a garbage collector in a one-man vehicle. They changed that. And then now it's always a two-man vehicle in the garbage truck. But there was a one-man vehicle for a long while. And if you remember, he discarded all of his victims in alleyways as trash. So this is what I think. The victims that were not found, or the identifications and photographs in the garage of the people that were never identified and never found, I believe that because he knew where he discarded them, the next morning he could do his normal truck route, garbage truck route, picking up the bodies that he'd killed that night before and take them to the dump, and then they were never seen again. But after a number of years, it went to a two-man truck. But I believe that the name The Grim Sleeper was when he was apparently lying dormant for 14 years. I don't believe he was. I think he was killing the entire time, but the bodies were not discovered because he was in a one-man truck. And now that never came out in trial. That is just my opinion. But a one-man truck, you can get away with murder. Excuse the pun, but you can really get away with anything.
Well, there was the evidence, too. You say they were left in alleyways, but there was also left in dumpsters covered in trash. So there was at least that some inkling that he had the ability to do that. And as you say, as a sanitation guide, I mean, it's a common way for killers to dispose of bodies. So.
Yes. Yeah.
It's not a big stretch.
It definitely is.
Not a big stretch.
No, not at all, sadly, no.
You talked about Detective Dupree, and you had a good relationship and rapport with him, and he's a heroic figure in this, if there is anyone at all, or a very solid, upstanding figure in this, Detective Dupree. When you talk to him, what does he estimate in terms of there's 10, he was convicted of 10, and then the attempted murder of Henrietta Washington. What does he think the tally is likely at?
He knows that there are countless more, but I never asked him at the specific number that he thinks, but there's no way it would have been just 10. That's impossible. I don't think anyone would think that. So definitely a lot more. And yeah, he's a fabulous homicide detective. He took this to heart. He was amazing with everybody, not just me, everybody. And he treats everybody the same. Any walk of life, he's a very, very likable man. I mean, Detective Kilcoyne and Coulter and Appelt and all the other guys are fabulous. I mean, it could have been done without them. But it's just I had the rapport with Dupree, because Dupree is one that has a rapport with everybody.
Mm-hmm. You talked about this, his name eludes me, Amster. The defense
Seymour
attorney,
Amster.
Seymour Amster. When we talk about, or people hear the phrase vigorous defense, that's what this person put on. But not to his defense, he went over and beyond what people would consider a vigorous defense, challenging with motions, challenging every single thing, going to sidebar. He did much more than that, didn't he? And some very odd behavior. Tell us about his behavior at this trial.
Well, do you know the term village idiot?
Yes.
Okay. I pretty much sums him up. He was a lunatic. I mean, he was beyond cruel. Most importantly, those family members, those innocent family members, had waited so long to get to trial, and I believe that was because of him delaying it. When we got to trial, he delayed it further. He delayed it with his antics. He delayed it with such bizarre excuses and interruptions. And Judge Kennedy is a lady judge, Kathleen Kennedy. She was excellent. I mean, she's dealing with probably the best prosecutor in America, Beth Silverman. She's a class act. She knows her stuff. She knows everything. She's articulate. She's got her facts down, and she's strong. And she's respectable of everybody in the courtroom. You've got the village idiot against her, right? You know, on the other side of the table, who's defending the serial killer. And you can't hold back but to lose the plot. And Judge Kennedy had to sort it out all the time. There was, I think he got fined for something. He would have outbursts. He would drop his suitcase, his briefcase, all over the floor. He'd come in late. His hair was all disheveled. He actually dropped the gun. I think I wrote that in my book.
Yeah.
When there was a witness on the stand. I mean, if you want Laurel and Hardy, but at least Stan Laurel was a good man. He ruined the lives of these innocent family members by delaying the process, hoping that cops would lose the evidence, witnesses wouldn't come forward, witnesses would die. But he didn't think that these innocent family members, they were elderly as well, and they had to take the bus there, or they had to drive there, they had to take time off work or out of their day every day just to get justice served for their loved one. And I blame it all on Seymour Hamster for acting so unprofessionally and cruelly, and not only costing the system thousands of dollars and costing us taxpayers, that's secondary. Importantly, what he did to those victims' family members, and of course tying up law enforcement's time, everything he did was completely selfish and totally unprofessional.
You talk about this trial being delayed 5.5 years before it gets to trial in 2016, but also that it's a 6-month trial. So pretty quite laborious for jurors and for everybody involved. And you say,
because
the victims' family members, some of them aged, would have to come there. It's very visual scenes that you write in the book about the family members that come there all the time, the stepmother of Barbara Ware, the Alexander family, mother, brother, sister, I believe. Tell us a little bit about that very emotional, their involvement in this very emotional and personal trial, obviously.
They held it together with complete decorum. And Barbara Ware's mother, Diane Ware, she was in very bad health, and she would make sure she was there for every day that she could. The Alexander family, they're just class act people. They're just wonderful feeling. I mean, even when I was just, I cannot believe that defense just said that. I just want to strangle it. You know, even they would hold it together. They would look at me and roll their eyes because they could not believe that a human being would be this distasteful and just unprofessional. So they held it together far better than, you know, I did. I did say a few things, choice words against him. And it, of course, out in the corridor, I was able to speak to the Alexander family quite a bit. And they just were just good people, kind people, wanting justice for their sister, their daughter. And then the last day of the actual, I think it was the sentencing or whatever it was, when each of them were able to get up to speak, I mean, there was not a dry eye in the gallery. There was not a dry eye. You felt their pain that they'd had for decades and decades. And then finally justice was served. But justice could have been served back in 2011, a year after he'd been charged with these crimes, these murders. It could have been done in 2011. And as I said, the defense was the one holding up the process. So the family members were there, and they were there because they knew they had to be. They wanted to be there because they felt each of their loved ones were there with them in that courtroom. That's what they would tell me. So it was there was nothing else they would do. There was nowhere else they would go but that courtroom to see justice served. Beautiful people, pure Christian, good, God-fearing, wonderful people these families are.
You talk about a very dramatic scene. Obviously, the survivor was instrumental in helping bring down this person, and also knowing things for certain that even if Lonnie Franklin were to admit, which he didn't, then Anitra Washington could attest to his MO and his signature and everything about what he likely did to all these other women. 10 and maybe much and probably more. She was at the trial. She's a star witness, of course. But then she's at the penalty phase after this guy's been given the death sentence by a jury or recommended. It's very dramatic. So what does she say about Lonnie Franklin when she has the opportunity in the very end when he's sentenced?
Ah, God, it's a long time ago. I quite can't remember, but I know she hated him, and for good reason. She hated him for what he did to her and the lives he took of so many others, countless others. So she really did not hold back on saying exactly how she felt. I mean, the audience, us in the gallery, we all were right there with her. We were right there in that car with her with the way she described everything so vividly and so specifically. She just had such disdain for him. And she was brilliant.
Yeah, you say that she called him, said he was so evil, and right up there with Charles Manson, and he destroyed her trust in men, no doubt. And she said he has no remorse, so there's no forgiveness allotted this man.
Good point. I didn't remember that, but my God, I admire her for saying that. I don't remember saying that, but this is many years ago. I've covered so many trials since then.
You say that the death penalty was imposed, Judge Kennedy, and he went to San Quentin. Interesting in part of your epilogue, you talk about Alicia Alexander, one of the victims. And, you know, you interacted with the family at the trial. Very interesting family and story behind her life and death. But there was somebody connected to her named Anita Limbrick. Tell us who she is and, just oddly, what she becomes in terms of her profession.
She's an L.A. County Sheriff. Yep, Anita Limbrick. That's exactly who she is. She's the sister of Monique Alexander. She's the sister.
Yeah.
And she was there a few times in the trial. Very, very sweet person. And very close to her sister. And they took two different paths because she was a tomboy as a kid. And Monique Alexander, she was a very feminine girl and liked to sing and dance and do all little fun, pretty things. So they were so close, yet they were so different in personality. So she would tell me all about the difference. But they were very close. And she took that path, and she went in the academy, and her sister was very excited for her going in the Sheriff Academy. But what happened was, I believe that it was when the day she was already in the academy, so it was right before the academy that Alicia was happy and excited about her sister doing this. But it was when she was actually beginning the academy when she was told that her sister had been killed. So you can imagine how much that affected her. And she still made it through, probably with the strength of and the support of her sister in heaven, giving her that strength to go on with the academy and made it as a sheriff. And she's been a sheriff for, gosh, I think 3 decades. She's an amazing person.
Yeah. We talked about, too, another dramatic, very, very dramatic thing. The woman, and I don't have her name in front of me, Ingrid, I believe, and she came in, they flew her in from Germany. Again, in the penalty phase, not in the trial phase, but in the penalty phase, to just make sure certain that this person got the sentence that he deserved, which everyone felt was death. So they brought in other witnesses. Again, of course, Amster objected, but other witnesses, other suspected people about other murders, they brought in everything they possibly could to try to convince the jury and the judge to make sure that this person would be considered the worst of the worst and deserving of the death penalty. She came in to testify. And when I mentioned this just a little while ago, I wanted to say that psychologically, you conclude in this book as well, that someone concludes that really what happened in Germany was when he was fooled by this woman who had been gang raped the night before, that from that point on, that when a woman he perceived as would have deceived him, then that's when he would take the his, then he would then resort to violence and murder because of a perceived slight.
I think he was, what got him to kill was not just the profession that they had. This was the one reason, the main reason most serial killers do that. But it was because that they, well, he was challenged in some way. I don't know about the word deceive. I see what you're saying. The German woman deceived him, brilliantly so. But no, these other, the people, the victims that got into his car, I don't think they were deceiving him as such, but possibly challenging him on something. And he can't take being challenged. As I said, you know, he's got the short man's complex. He's got the inferiority complex from being bullied as a child. So no, he was not going to have that happen again. So more than deceive, I would say he was challenged and that's it. He snapped. But I also think it was premeditated. He would get these women in the car and know that they were going to be killed. So that at the point that he killed them was when they probably challenged him on something. I wasn't in the car. You know, we don't really know. And of course, I didn't speak to him about specifically about his crimes because he was not, he was in trial and he was in the jail. He hadn't got to death row. Now he's on death row, along with 748 others, because there's 749 people on California death row. And, you know, he's going to sit there until he dies of natural causes. He won't be getting the death penalty, sadly. So he will sit there like everybody else because of this liberal state that won't kill anybody.
Yes, absolutely. And you being a very prolific author here and journalist, you were working on something else that coincidentally this trial was going on at the same time as some of those people that you consider friends, some of those people that you have been around for quite a while, they're involved in some case, and you are working on a new book about that case. Maybe just tell us a little bit before we let you go about what you're working on as a result of these two cases coming up around the same time at trial.
Yeah, you have to shut me up at some point because I could go on forever. But in 2011, the actual time, I was in the Men's Central Jail interviewing Lonnie. And as you know, I've got friends in that department that gave you three times extra time. And the person who ran the jail at the time was a lieutenant called Greg Thompson. God bless him. He's in jail. He's in prison right now in Wisconsin. But it was him instrumental in getting me the extra time with Lonnie Franklin because he ran the jail and he's known me since I was 19. But I didn't know it was him. So it was just very sweet. Sadly, in 2011, in the summer of 2011, the FBI decided to smuggle a cell phone into the Men's Central Jail, one of the most illegal forms of contraband. They smuggled it into a man by the name of Anthony Brown, facing 420 or 25 years in state prison. His cellmate was a guy that was up for attempted homicide. They smuggled that in illegally. They didn't ask the Sheriff's Department permission first. And in fact, they were quite evasive about even working with the Sheriff's Department when the Sheriff's Department wanted to just reach out and say, what are we doing here with the cell phone? When, of course, it was discovered that the last call was an FBI building. So the Sheriff's Department were wanting to work with the FBI. Let's investigate jail abuse, if that's what you're here for, because they were investigating jail abuse, which is actually what's called discipline in a Republican world. Anyway, so they're investigating jail abuse in lifetime because they wanted this Anthony Brown to take video of lifetime, in lifetime of abuse that went on, which really wasn't, so nothing was on the phone. But because the FBI weren't working with the Sheriff's Department, it became a turf war, and they hid the inmate because the inmate was a risk to himself. It was a danger to have him in the general population. So they hid him. They took him away from the Men's Central Jail to San Dimas Jail. They changed his name. They took him out of the system. So when the FBI went to visit him, they said, there's never been somebody here called Anthony Brown. Well, then the fight was on. But they were doing it for their own protection and for Anthony Brown's protection. And the FBI would say differently. They would say that the Sheriff's Department were obstructing a federal investigation and conspiracy to obstruct a federal investigation. When the Sheriff's Department went to Leah Marks' home, she was Special Agent Marks. She was the one who actually was the person who got the cell phone smuggled in by a dirty cop by the name of Gilbert Michelle into the jail. They went to her and they said, we've got a warrant for your arrest, so you better not come to our jail. Well, that wasn't true. So another charge on all these six deputies, sergeants, lieutenants, the undersheriff, and a captain, they were all charged with conspiracy to obstruct an investigation, obstructing a federal investigation, and lying to federal investigators. So, yes, this is what happened. So while that cell phone and the scandal was going on, I was visiting Lonnie Franklin. When the trial came up for my dear friends who all know me since I was 19, I went there and I heard the testimony and I heard the, and I was in some of the trials. So I was running from the federal building to the criminal courts building and trying to cover both trials at the same time. It was a bit tough, but I've got the energy to do it. And I did as much as I could. I would like to work on a book. It would be a fabulous book, but who would my readers be? That's the only thing, because it is very specific to the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department. Every single one of them, I believe, in my opinion, are wrongly convicted. They were just following orders from above. They were just following those orders of the undersheriff, Tanaka, and they did what they were told. Not one of them deserves to be in prison, and it's devastating because one of these innocent men, Sergeant Scott Craig, he's got stage 4 cancer, and they won't even let him out a few months early. So it's horrible. And I went to visit Lieutenant Greg Thompson in Wisconsin, in Oxford. I went out to visit him about 5 months ago while I was in between working on ships. So, yes, I visited him as well. And I'm in touch with him every day on the email because they can email out of prison. And I work out with the captain, who is now out of prison as well. I work out with him every morning at the gym. I won't say where I live, but I work when I'm in between ships, like I am for a few months. I work out at a gym, with the captain of Internal Criminal Investigations Bureau. So they've been through the ringer, these guys.
Yeah, well, incredibly reversing fortunes. Very, very interesting. And congratulations on that work. I'm sure that they are happy that you're in their corner, at least, at the very, very least.
Definitely.
I want to thank you very much, Victoria Redstall, for coming on and talking about The Grim Sleeper, talking with America's most notorious serial killer, Lonnie Franklin Jr. It's been an absolute pleasure, Victoria. For those that might want to take a look at your other work, do you have a Facebook page? Website.
Oh, yes.
Tell us about that, please.
I've got my website is victoriaredstall.com. That's REDSTALL.com. My books are available on Amazon, UK Amazon, and also America Amazon. Facebook, yes, I have a what's called a like page. I think it's a fan page. But I've been living on a ship for 4 months in Alaska, so I haven't done much work on camera. I did yesterday a TV show, which I'll put on my Facebook page soon. And absolutely, Facebook and Twitter sometimes, Instagram, but mainly Facebook is where my work is. And my website, victoriaredstall.com.
Thank you very much, Victoria Redstall. Hope to talk to you again real soon. It's been a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Dan. Thank you. Good night.
Good night.